This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Monday, the Supreme Court handed down important decisions on affirmative action and the University of Michigan. The results were mixed, but affirmative action proponents were generally pleased. We're not going to be talking about that case this hour. What we are going to be talking about is an idea in the written decision that affirmative action is a temporary answer, that in 25 years the need for affirmative action should end. Specifically, the majority stated that, quote, race-conscious admissions policies must be limited in time. The court takes the law school at its word that it would like nothing better than to find a race-neutral admissions formula and will terminate its use of racial preferences as soon as practicable. The court expects that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest approved today. In other words, the ideal is a government that's colorblind. In our day-to-day lives, though, in business, in school, and in politics, do we want a race-neutral society? When do we want to be identified by our race, and when don't we? Does it matter on a medical form, in the census, on a loan application? What sort of racial or cultural identity do you want your kids to grow up with, if any? If you're the child of an interracial family, you probably already walk back and forth between the two cultures. When and how do you identify with which side of your family? Our phone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And our first guest is Andrea Guerrero. She's an attorney and the author of Silence at Bolt Hall, The Dismantling of Affirmative Action. She joins us from her office in San Diego, California. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
What do you make of the social implications of the Supreme Court's decision about race neutrality in 25 years?
Well, I think the court is presuming that in 25 years we will be much further than where we are today. However, the court has not addressed in its decision, and we as a country have not seriously addressed the embedded preferences that presently exist in our institutions, including higher education admissions process. And until we seriously address those, then any forecast as to when we will no longer need affirmative action is mere speculation.
Obviously, a significant minority on the court thought we didn't need it anymore today, and you're saying even in 25 years it's not going to be possible. And is it one thing to look at it in society in general, or another thing to look at it in terms of its effects on government, which was what, of course, the court was writing about?
Well, it is, because under our laws, in order to consider race, you have to have a compelling government interest. And in the case of the affirmative action scenario before the court, having a diverse student body serve in the public schools serve the governmental interest of having a generation of leaders that was reflective of and responsive to the ethnic and racial diversity of the given state.
That looks like America.
It looks like America, that can respond to America, that knows the ins and outs of the cultural norms and is familiar with the problems that exist in different communities and can educate others and respond to those problems in the position of leadership.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. When does race matter? Our first caller is Gary, who joins us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Well, I've thought a lot about this issue, and it seems to me that race neutrality really shouldn't be the goal. I think it's unrealistic to expect people to ignore race, especially visible differences like skin color. It's a part of everyone's identity. We shouldn't fixate on it. It shouldn't be made the be-all and end-all, which is why I'm glad the Michigan Law School case came out the way it did. But I think often it's used by conservatives as a cover for them to ignore what Ms. Guerrero mentioned, the embedded preferences, the privileges white people get just by virtue of being white. And race neutrality often is carried about by people who 50 years ago or 200 years ago were anything but race neutral in their policies and attitudes toward blacks and other groups. So I just wonder how we're ever going to get to a place where we can treat each other as individuals but also recognize the significance of group membership when the powers that be often aren't willing to look at white privilege and how it works to benefit some people at the expense of others.
Are we going to be, Gary, do you think, closer to this goal in 25 years?
I'm an optimist, so I'll say yes. And I think if I look at my own family experiences and those of my friends, you know, as the generations go, we're a little less racist than we used to be. But I don't know that that's going to get us all the way there to a society which, you know, values all of its members for what they have to contribute, while still acknowledging that, yes, race has played a huge part in American history. It's, you know, interwoven into our founding documents, the Constitution, and it seems like we want to just pretend that all that stuff didn't happen, and, you know, isn't all that bad segregation stuff behind us, and can't we just, you know, all get along now? And I think that's oversimplifying stuff that's much more complicated and tricky than all that.
Well, let me ask Andrea Guerrero about one of the points you made, Gary. And is a race-neutral society, is that a goal?
Well, I think race-neutral in the law, race-neutral in the application of programs and the extension of benefits, whether we as a society are race-conscious to the good of race relations, I think is a related but different question. Unfortunately, the court has a very strict standard as to when race can be applied, even if it's considered a good to society at large, which I would, you know, consider affirmative action to be.
Mm-hmm. An interesting answer in terms of the court, but it doesn't answer the question. Is a race-neutral society what we want?
That's a question that, you know, we collectively have to answer. I think our goal shouldn't be mere race neutrality, but race sensitivity, race consciousness that does not allow race to be considered to the detriment of a particular group. And how that's dissected in the law is a little bit different than how that's dissected in the public debate.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to extend it, I mean, there are a lot of ethnic or racially conscious groups that all of us are members of, whether it's the Hibernian Society or the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Are those good things, or are those things that we should seek to grow out of as a society?
Well, I think they're part of our heritage, and I think you ask any American and they'll be able to tell you proudly where they come from, even if that place that they came from was generations ago. And I think color consciousness is what we have been, always are, and probably always will be. And I think our goal should be, you know, race sensitivity instead of race neutrality, which many have said under race neutral measures, people are blind to my race. And that is not to my benefit.
Gary, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thanks for taking this topic on, Neil.
Okay. And Andrea Guerrero, just before we let you go, one of the other factors that's going to be important in 25 years is that the United States, America, will look different 25 years from now than it does today. You know, demographics works its inevitable change. The Latino population, by every projection, is going to be considerably larger than today.
Well, that's correct. In places like California and Texas, coming even faster. However, that doesn't change the fact that 75% of Hispanic students in the country attend predominantly minority schools. It doesn't change the fact that Latinos are the most likely to drop out, the most likely to not go on to college. We are facing a crisis in education in the Latino community, and the fact that our numbers are increasing makes it that much more of a problem, but the mere growth of the population is not resolving the problem. Until resources are dedicated and interest is directed at the crisis in education that we have not resolved in these past 25 years since we instituted affirmative action, we still have the embedded preferences working for white students, such as legacies, and we still have underfunded and poor resource schools educating our minority students.
Andrea Guerrero, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
She is the author of Silence at Bolt Hall, The Dismantling of Affirmative Action, and spoke with us from her office in San Diego. And joining us now is Carol Swain, a professor of law and political science at Vanderbilt University, the author of The New White Nationalism in America, Its Challenge to Integration, and thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Do you think Americans should cling to their racial identities or seek to let them go?
Well, I strongly believe that our nation is so racially diverse that it would serve our interests better if we thought of ourselves as one America, and that the clinging to racial identity, that it's, you know, at this point it's counterproductive, it's destructive, and it's pushing us in the wrong directions.
So you would agree with the Supreme Court that in 25 years enough is enough?
No, I think that the Supreme Court made a serious mistake by not ending racial preferences immediately, because the policies that they upheld are policies, I think, that are worsening the race relationships in America, and it's not really reaching the needs of the poorest minorities or the poorest whites. And those groups are being left behind, because what the case was really about is elite education and whether or not a student is going to go to Harvard or Duke.
And I apologize for misputting that question. We really don't want to talk about the affirmative action case in general, but about where we're going to be in 25 years and about the goals, the idea of this race-neutral society. Are there times when, you know, there are so many occasions on which we identify ourselves, again, by our ethnic or
I don't think that race, I think that race will always be with us, and that people do tend to cling and identify with their own groups, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they hate people of other groups or that they're going to discriminate. But I think there's something about human nature that causes individuals to lean towards members of their own group, that we have to accept that and we have to work within that. I think the nation today is too racially diverse for us to have government-sanctioned racial preference policies. I believe that the Supreme Court or somebody will have to revisit this issue in less than 25 years, because it's something that's going to split the nation apart. It pits blacks against Hispanics, Hispanics against blacks, whites against blacks, and it's very destructive.
Why does this continue to dominate the national conversation?
Because poll after poll, surveys, numerous surveys have shown that the overwhelming majority of Americans of all races oppose policies of racial preference. And so if you talk to the average American, white or black, this is not what they want. What they do want is to live in a society where people are treated fairly. And I think it's very important for us to make a distinction between affirmative action as outreach, non-discrimination, equal opportunity, and remedial assistance to people that are disadvantaged, make a distinction between that and racial preference policies. The majority of people support affirmative action, but they don't support racial preferences.
We are talking about racial identity, its merits, and its drawbacks. Do we want to be seen by our race first, second, or maybe not at all? And is a colorblind society a desirable goal? We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to take more of your calls. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing racial identity. Should the U.S. strive to become a race-neutral society, colorblind? Is that a desirable goal? Our guest is Carol Swain. She's a professor of law and political science at Vanderbilt University. She's with us from her office in Nashville. How do you decide what emphasis to place on your racial identity? Do you think that's changed over your lifetime? And if you grew up in a racially mixed family, you may have special insights. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller. Al joins us on the line from Boston.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm the son of an Asian father and a Caucasian mother, and I grew up in a poor part of New Jersey. I got beat up by white kids and by black kids, and there was no one else like me anywhere in town. So I can say I definitely don't identify with any race, but from my point of view, I can see that we definitely live in a very white society, and it's my hope that someday the norm will be people like me, that there will be so much mixing, it's probably hundreds of years down the road, that, you know, it won't make a difference anymore.
Carol Swain, as populations change and develop, and certainly there are many more people who on the most recent census form identified themselves as a mixed race of one sort or another.
But that doesn't stop racism between and among groups. And if you go to parts of California, there's a lot of hostility between different ethnic groups, and a lot of that has to do with racial preferences, who's getting what, when, and how. Your question about whether it's desirable to have race neutrality in a colorblind society, it may be desirable. Is it practical? Is it going to happen in 25 years? I don't think so. And so what I think we need to do is focus on public policies that reduce racial tensions, move away from identity politics, and try to embrace that American national ideal. And I believe that there's one race, the human race, and that a lot of the issues that the callers raise, the issues that are brought up are about social class and not about race. But we're so focused on race and on things that don't really matter that we're missing the larger picture.
Al, was it a question of class in your experience, or was it race?
It was definitely race, and I am very much in support of affirmative action because the way I've seen it, we've had affirmative action for white people for a couple hundred years now.
And we still have affirmative action for white people, and I would argue that the policies that we have in place today that was supported by so many elite institutions, it serves their needs. It does nothing for the minorities that are poor, and it certainly does nothing for poor whites. That it's something that's like window dressing. Some of those same institutions that supported affirmative action are some of the worst abusers of rights. Of civil rights and individual rights. They discriminate against minorities. They use that support, that verbal support for affirmative action as a covering.
Well, Al, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And Professor Swain, obviously you are a professor. Are kids today hearing different messages about racial identity than they did when you were in college?
They are, and I think that a lot of people don't understand racial double standards. And by racial double standards, I mean the fact that if you're an ethnic or racial minority, you're encouraged to celebrate your heritage and to basically separate yourselves. And there's a whole different standard for evaluating your conversation and what you do and how you think. And there are many young whites that see the racial double standards on college campuses and places like that, and they really don't understand it. And my concern, and the concern I talk about in my books, The New White Nationalism in America, is the fact that those multiculturalist arguments that minorities have used, that now whites are using those as well. And so we're pushing more white people into identity politics, and I think that either we pull away from it for everyone and embrace that American national identity, or we must allow whites to join in too, and then we become more balkanized, more divided than ever before, because everyone is doing that group interest politics based on race and ethnicity, and we're forgetting the whole that we're all in America together, we're all in this pot together, we stand or fall together.
Carol Swain, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carol Swain is the author also of Contemporary Voices of White Nationalism. She's a law professor at Vanderbilt University and joined us from her office in Nashville, Tennessee. And with us now from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Nathan Glaser, an emeritus professor of sociology at Harvard. And good of you to join us today.
Thank you.
In 25 years, will we still be counting heads in the United States and identifying people by race?
I think we still will. If we go back 25 years, we have seen changes of various kinds, but we certainly haven't seen a decline in the degree to which people identify themselves by race and ethnic group. I think there will be one change in 25 years that will portend further changes for the next 25 years, and that is we do see an increasing degree of intermarriage among all groups aside from blacks, though among blacks there's also an increasing degree of intermarriage, except that it begins from a much lower starting point, mm-hmm. and therefore its increase, even if substantial by percentage standards, does not really reach more than 5-10% of the population.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, why is that? It is a long history. After all, blacks were the one group that were defined all through American history as inferior and is to be separated until the 1960s. There were laws in probably a third of the states against racial intermarriage, and particularly directed against blacks. And there is a heritage from American history of 350 years, which is also passed on to all those Americans, inevitably, whose ancestors were not here 350 years ago, and among recent immigrants, and it will take a long time for that heritage of difference and sense of strong difference and distance to be eliminated. I support the achievement of a race-blind society, in a society in which race plays no role in either advancing or hindering any individual. The kind of affirmative action that has been developed among the colleges and universities is something that leads us to that end, even though by taking race into account. And so I support the decision of the Supreme Court, the major decision supporting taking race into account. I support even more the fact that they've gotten beyond the one basis for justifying that constitutionally that the defendants could think of, and that was diversity. And the chief decision does point out that it's important to bring important subgroups into American elites. It refers to the briefs by the American generals, by the big corporations, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There is a consensus that this is a way of producing a more unified and stable society. And I know that one can make powerful arguments against it, as Professor Swain has done, but I still think the overwhelming sentiment among American elites, educational, military, business, with whatever grumblings, is that this kind of policy is necessary.
Our telephone number again, 800-989-8255, email TOTN at NPR.org. Our next caller is Rob, who is with us from Pasadena. Hello, Rob, are you there? Rob?
This is Stuart DeYoung from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Ah, I'm sorry. I must have punched the wrong button. I was hoping to get Rob in Pasadena.
Well, hey, I'm glad to be here.
Well, hold on. We'll be back to you. Let's try, is this Rob? Hello, Rob, is this you?
No.
This is Josh. Josh is with us from Indianapolis. Okay, Josh, you go ahead.
All right. Well, I have a comment to make, but first I'd like to ask a question. Neil, can you tell me what your hair color is? Because I want to make sure it's okay for me to talk to you.
I see. Well, my hair color is not important in this context, I don't believe.
Exactly, and that's my point. I'm a white man. I have five children, two of which are adopted Haitian American daughters. Mm. I've got beautiful, wonderful daughters. And personally, I think that the problem is that our government can't legislate this. It's got to be a change in attitudes of the people themselves. My own kids get razzed, and they're called little white girls by some people. They're called horrible expletives by others occasionally, but I'm pleased to say that it has diminished dramatically in the last decade or so. But the government can't step in and say it's got to be a change in attitudes in people's minds and beliefs. That's what I thought.
Nathan Glazer, certainly the Supreme Court decision is important. It's got us all thinking about this, but whatever change is going to happen in the society is not going to be coming out of a piece of paper from the court.
I think the point just made by the caller is, of course, very important. I think those attitudes have changed. One index of those changes are things like public opinion polls on would you object to intermarriage or having people of other races live next to you, and so on. And we see huge drops in that, which can be accounted for in part by changes in attitude, in part by changes in public opinion as to what kind of attitudes are legitimate. And in that sense, the Supreme Court plays an important role. Even with 5-4 decisions, it sets a standard, and it makes a reasoned argument, as the decision did, and whose major points were that no, we won't go to quotas, but yes, we do want to accept the autonomy of institutions of higher education to choose their student body, as we always have accepted. This has always been a country, for the most part, that was not dependent strictly on grades and cutoff points, but always involved some kind of discretion on the part of the educational institution for students of different kinds. Mm. I'm not saying that was universal, but it was very widely accepted. I think we need changes of heart in terms of seeing other groups inferior, but I also think that Supreme Court decisions play a role in making those changes.
Well, you know, my thought here is that if we're going to legislate, if we're going to bring this into the court system, we should approach it from the other side, and instead of saying that this quota practice or this method of rating people or whatnot. Instead, we should criminalize when people don't get their fair due. So a child that grows up in an inner-city school and is underserved, quite frankly, that's a crime. That's a problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And perhaps the solution here is to remedy that problem and see that everyone has equal access to equal opportunities.
Well, Josh, I can see a case for a metaphorical crime, but you're going to throw somebody in jail because of that?
Well, you know what? If that's a very good question.
Okay, Josh.
Let me intervene by saying we do throw people in jail for, or at least fine them, and sometimes throw them in jail for direct discrimination.
That's a little different.
Employment in selling houses and so on. Not that it doesn't go on, but we have strong laws and we have pretty effective institutions that do make it clear that this kind of behavior is legislated against. What we I want to point out that the Supreme Court decision, while it was an issue of litigation, did not deal with any federal law or even any state law. It was dealing with the voluntary actions of institutions of higher education. And I think that's important. I would oppose any law at the level of state or federal government which tries to impose a practice of saying you must have so many blacks or you must have so many Hispanic Americans. I would be against that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Unfortunately, we don't have it.
Well, Josh, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
And Professor Glaser, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Nathan Glaser is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Harvard University, and he was with us from his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The Federal Reserve Board has lowered interest rates again, dropping the rate banks charge each other for loans to 1%, the lowest it's been since 1958. You can hear that story and more later today on All Things Considered. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And as we consider continue our discussion on whether the goal of a race-neutral society is a good one, joining us now from her office in Atlanta, Georgia, is Beverly Daniel Tatum. She's president of Spelman College, an historically black women's school, and the author of Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race. And it's good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, I'm pleased to be here. Thank you.
Is there a role for racial identity and where?
There absolutely is a role for racial identity in a race-conscious society, and we still have one. So when you are growing up, whether as a young African-American or Latino or Asian or Native American or white person, your racial membership plays a role in how people perceive you, respond to you. And so it is, of course, a part of your identity, just as your gender is a part of your identity or your ethnic background or religious tradition. Because it shapes how you have experienced the world and how people in the world experience you. Now, how much emphasis gets placed on race or racial group membership. And it's important to say, of course, that what I'm referring to as race is really not a biologically valid, but is a social construct. But when we think about the experience of race in the world and how it impacts people's expectations sometimes, teachers' expectations in classrooms or children's interactions with one another, your previous caller who talked about his Haitian-American daughters, certainly they are having an experience different from that of their siblings, who their adoptive siblings who are not Haitian-American. And so one's racial identity does matter in terms of your lived experience.
Here's an email we got from Tracy in San Jose, California. My children, she writes, are 50% Indian and 50% European. We live in a wonderfully multicultural community in San Jose. That said, I am constantly amazed with the obsession with race categorization in this country. We recently refinanced our mortgage and opted not to provide our race. My husband was surprised to find that the mortgage officer categorized him as white based on a telephone conversation. That sort of data is not only insulting, she writes, it's meaningless.
Well, it absolutely is not reflecting his experience when somebody does that, assuming that he himself does not identify as white. But it does speak to the bank's need to keep statistics to demonstrate that they have not been discriminating. But clearly that's an example of the misuse of that categorization. But whether people are asking you or not, it certainly is impacting your daily interactions with others.
We're talking about whether the United States should be a race-neutral society, whether that's a worthy goal, and if so, how and when, and if not, why not? When we come back from a short break, we're going to also mark George Orwell's 100th birthday with columnist Christopher Hitchens, who's going to join us. If you'd like to join our conversation on either subject, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about racial identity and whether the U.S. should become a race-neutral society. Our guest right now is Beverly Daniel Tatum, president of Spelman College, the author of Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race. And let's get some callers involved. John joins us on the line from Anaheim, California.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a retired academic who was actively involved in the creation of affirmative action programs in California in the 80s, especially at the graduate level. But I have a comment about whether we should be race neutral or otherwise. We've already lost a significant cultural, historical, and social benefits to the country by being as race neutral as we have been, and by denying our history of diversity. Let me give you an example. The first European immigrants to the United States came from Mexico. This isn't in American history books, and very few people know this. The first successful Revolutionary War fought against a European monarch was fought in 1680 in New Mexico. It's not in American history books. The role of Hispanics, so-called Hispanics, in America is totally undervalued. There was an article in the LA Times about how Hispanics are now the number one minority, yet they lack the historical grounding and significance in America that African Americans have, and it compromises our political influence as a consequence. That's incredible ignorance of American history. But it's not the press's fault. It's the historians and the now this happened as a consequence of unjust political processes. I mean, Americans need to know American history, and they don't.
Okay, John. Thanks very much for the call. President Tatum, would you agree, accept that as an example of one reason why race matters?
Well, what I want to talk a little bit about the term race neutral. And I think what's important to say is that we want to get to a place where we do not discriminate against people on the basis of what we are referring to now as race. Clearly, we want to get to that state that Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King talked about, where people are judged by their character and not the color of their skin.
Mm-hmm.
However, when you say to me we should be race neutral, what that sometimes gets translated into is being colorblind. And I don't think we want to be a colorblind society, meaning that we want to notice the differences that are among us, not to discriminate, but to acknowledge and appreciate those differences.
We have an email on this point that I thought you might want to respond to. This is from David Levy in St. Louis. I think it's important to distinguish between race-neutral and raceless, he says. Race-neutral does not mean that race is ignored, but that it does not bear on the decisions or judgments. By taking the matter of race out of the decision would, in theory, over time, result in a representative population in schools, the workplace, etc. That does not appear to happen in the U.S. today, and therefore we have to allow race to be considered. In 25 years, we may be more neutral, but I hope we are not raceless.
And I would agree with that position. And that, I think, is an important thing when we talk about these issues, to be clear about what we mean by the term. Because for some people, they might say, well, we would like to get to a place where we don't even talk about race at all. And in an ideal world, I actually think we would talk about the human race as a whole, as opposed to the artificial categories that have been created over time. But it is important that even if we were talking about the human race and not these artificial categories we describe in terms of, you know, black, white, et cetera, it would be important to acknowledge that there are still going to be differences in terms of cultural expression. There are going to be differences in terms of religious beliefs and assumptions. There are going to be differences in experience as a result of geographic affiliation or gender. I mean, there are going to be differences that are important and rich, much like the, you know, the analogy of the salad bowl. You know, you want a variety of flavors in that salad bowl, and to bring those things together, you don't want to necessarily puree them all into a tasteless mess.
President Tatum, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Beverly Daniel Tatum is the president of Spelman College and joined us from her office in Atlanta.